Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor'ı dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumhi ekta The Fifth Floor farnak amidi sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. On December 10th, 2023, Javier Milei, a right-wing economist turned politician, took office as Argentina's president.
Mr. Milei, known as El Loco, or the madman, pulled off a major upset. Provisional results.
Javier Milei went viral during his campaign around the world for campaigning with a chainsaw, which was his symbol for his desire to slash the state and slash public spending.
For Argentina, this was a political earthquake, and his victory sent a clear message. Argentinians wanted change.
The situation in Argentina is critical. The changes our country needs are drastic. There is no room for gradualism. There is no room for half measures.
What has his government done so far, and what's changed for people in the country? Veronica Smink of BBC Mundo has been following Javier Milei's political journey and joins me from Buenos Aires. Hola, Veronica. How are you?
Hola, hello.
Great to have you on the program. So just remind us all who Javier Milei is. He's quite a colorful character, isn't he?
Well, many Argentines are just starting to get to know Javier Milei. Just a few years ago, he was well known for being on television. He was just an economist who was invited as a panelist. Argentina, as I'm sure many other countries have the same thing, have, you know, a lot of programs where people are invited to discuss issues. And he just became well known for being, you know, loud, eccentric. And they started realizing that when he was invited, the ratings started going up because he had this flamboyant personality, you know, these eccentric ideas. He really caught people's attention, and that's how he started getting known. And then just only 2 years back, he jumped into the political arena when he ran for a place in the House of Representatives representing the city of Buenos Aires. People were saying, oh, look at that. This economist from television is now a deputy. But no one expected him to rise so quickly and certainly not to be the president 2 years later.
And when he talks, he peppers these political speeches with football metaphors. And he's a big fan of Rolling Stones as well.
I'm a true fan of the Rolling Stones. I actually had a Rolling Stones tribute band I sang in, so I deeply admire Mick Jagger.
Yes, that's right. He used to be a goalkeeper as well. He knows his crowd, Argentines, are big football fans. Sometimes he quotes Maradona, or he might mention something about Boca Juniors, his team. It's not like he's constantly making references of football or the Rolling Stones, but he certainly talks about his love of popular culture and not only Rolling Stones, he's also impersonated Elvis.
Yeah, he has sideburns like Elvis.
Yes, but also like his political hero, Carlos Menem, former President Carlos Menem, so... We haven't asked him about, you know, who he's trying to emulate. But he has all these words that he himself has put into popular culture. For instance, when you have to eliminate something, a lot of people will say, afuera. Afuera means out, because that's how he said, you know, when he was going to cut the ministries in half. It's afuera this, afuera the other.
Ministerio de Ciencia y Tecnología e Innovación. Afuera. Ministerio de Trabajo, Empleo y Seguridad Social. Afuera.
And there are others, too. He has all these expressions about, for instance, he considers economists who criticize him econochantas, which is a play of words on economist, and chanta, which means swindler. He's amazing with all these new expressions that he's put. And then people just start, you know, they become part of popular culture.
And you've actually met him in person. How is he when you see him in person?
Yes, that's right. I was part of the BBC delegation that went to interview him when correspondent Ione Wells interviewed him a few months back. And I remember at the time, you know, everyone was tiptoeing around him. But other than that, I remember talking to his secretary who told me that He was the nicest guy, had never had a harsh word with her. And I got the sense that, you know, that persona that you see on stage is actually that, a persona. Mm. That he understands, he said it himself, that to lead what he calls this war against the left, against, you know, progressives, against what in the US is called wokeness. And he realized that, especially on social media, that people who are loud and angry and aggressive and violent seem to get people's attention. Mm. And so he seems to be using this in his favor.
And what do people say about his behavior, his unconventional views? Who are his fan base, basically?
Well, his fan base are mostly men under 35, but more and more people are starting to get to know him. And there are some, especially obviously his fans, who say he's just a genuine guy who says what he thinks. I know this very unpresidential behavior that he has is actually proof that he's not just another politician, which was what many Argentines really voted for. Because if you ask people back then in December why they voted for Milei, a lot of people said, I just needed a change. And he certainly is a change. However, his critics say that he's taken this aggressiveness and this attacks against, especially against the press, to a level that they think endanger democracy. Perhaps his flamboyance is not so much of a worry as this style of attacking anybody who thinks differently.
It's very similar to what is happening in the United States as well, basically. It's kind of this frustration with the establishment.
That's right. Mm. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the first foreign president that Donald Trump met was Javier Milei. Mm. They definitely have a lot in common. And as you say, particularly in this style, very confrontational style, I think Milei has described it as just the tactic that they're using to get, you know, to get back at the left and get the center. They think it's a cultural war. Mm. This is a very important part of who Milei is. It's not just the economy. It's a cultural war against the left.
During his campaign, famously, he carried a chainsaw around, basically saying that he's going to slash public spending. How is it going? How is the chainsaw working?
It definitely worked. And from day one, he slashed public spending by a third. And that has had, you know, real dire consequences. Just in the first trimester, poverty jumped 11 points, the biggest jump in 20 years. Of course, Milei says it's not something he did. He just basically was updating the situation that they had left him, no? He calls it a sinceramiento de precios, which means like making, you know, the prices more honest, saying, look, this is the real price of how much things were, and it's not what they were telling you before. All the prices were regulated. This is the real value of things. But obviously for Argentines who already had lost huge purchasing power in the past 5 to 10 years, and who had, you know, the highest inflation in the world, suddenly having, you know, a lot of the things that they had to pay going up massively, their salary not going up, this was really, really harsh. However, it has to be said that his main goal was to lower inflation, and he is doing that.
But obviously, these are austerity measures, and people do feel the pinch of it. What do they say about it, and how do they feel about this?
Well, the latest surveys show that Javier Milei clearly is getting a lot of support from people who see that all this effort seems to have been working. His popularity levels are back to where they were when he was elected a year ago, around, you know, between 50-56%. And that says a lot about someone who came with a chainsaw and slashed the economy. At least for the moment, it seems to be working. Argentines are seeing inflation. When he came in December, just the monthly inflation went above 25%. Imagine that, just in 1 month. And it's gone to below 3%, which sounds like a huge amount for another country. But for Argentina, it's actually very little.
Mm. So, Veronica, BBC's Ione Wells interviewed Javier Milei this April, and she told him that some people are finding it extremely difficult to cope with his austerity plans. Let's hear a clip from that interview.
You promised that the political class, not the people, would pay. I spoke to a pensioner here who told me that, in tears, that this, in her words, was a lie, that with cuts to pensions, salaries, the value of people's money, it's people like her who are paying. What would you say to her?
Bueno, la verdad es que eso es falso.
Well, actually, that is false. The largest adjustment is being paid by the political corporation.
Do you know how much a liter of milk costs now in Buenos Aires?
Do you know how many goods assets exist within an economy? So you don't do economics based on the price of an individual asset. In economics, miracles don't exist. What would have been the alternative? To continue to print money like the previous administration that generates inflation and ends up affecting the most vulnerable?
I was translating Ioni's question to Milei into Spanish, and Ioni was basically putting to him that a pensioner, and bear in mind that the pensioners were the ones who bear the biggest brunt of the cut, that, you know, she was struggling. And instead of saying, yes, well, it's necessary, I understand, he was just saying, no, that's not true. He was just looking at the macroeconomics of it and saying, well, this was something necessary. This woman is going to do better. But it was a complete lack of empathy. And this is something that many people have mentioned about Milei. For instance, when he talks about slashing the state, he's called the state his enemy. He wants to destroy the state. And he celebrates every time he announces cuts. And, you know, many people put to him that these are actual people who are losing their jobs, a family that won't have, you know, their income that month. And yes, okay, we understand that you have to cut spending in Argentina was a massive problem. We understand that that was causing inflation, but let's not celebrate.
What else did he say in that interview about the economy and his plans?
Well, even back then, when we were just coming out of the worst, bear in mind that in April when we did the interview, that's when Argentina touched rock bottom in terms of, you know, the biggest recession. That's when people stopped buying completely. But he seemed so clear, so optimistic about what was coming. And, you know, to be fair, it would seem to have come through. If you look at the situation now, reserves in the central bank, which he inherited in the red, you know, are back okay. As I said before, the inflation gone down. Argentina's bonds and stocks are at record prices. And certainly Argentina, although consumption, it's slowly starting to grow, at least it stopped falling. So I wouldn't say that, you know, things are doing great here, but certainly compared to what they were in April, his optimism has seemed to come to fruition.
And another focus of his campaign was the security. So what was the situation of Argentina like when he was talking about security issues during his campaign?
That's right. He said the main two things I came to do is, you know, fix the economy, especially inflation, and the security issues. There's a place in Argentina, a city called Rosario, where it's a port city, and there was a huge drugs problem, a narco problem, which was getting out of hand. Rosario had become the homicide capital of Argentina. And as soon as he came in and he named his former rival in the elections, center-right candidate Patricia Bullrich, as his security minister, a role that she had done before. And together they came up with a plan. They used federal forces to go into Rosario. And homicides have dropped dramatically in Rosario. So that's another thing that he's proud about. And the other thing is, for many, many years in Argentina, it was very common for anybody who had any, you know, claim or a grievance, or, you know, all protests were just, they cut streets. You know, you wouldn't be able to go through the city of Buenos Aires on a normal day. You would have to ask, well, which of the streets are cut? It was such a common way of protesting. It has a name here, they're called piquetes. And basically, he just also eliminated the piquetes. You can only use the sidewalks to protest. And they basically got rid of piquetes.
And people are happy about that.
Not his critics, who say that Argentines should have a right to protest. And, you know, this was very common for many years. But certainly you talk to people who finally can go through the city of Buenos Aires and not have to stop 20 times and change course and all that. They're happy about it. And no doubt people are really relieved that the situation in Rosario didn't get out of hand, because at a time it seemed also that it could have spread to the rest of the country.
And Veronica, what do you think his political legacy will be? Do you think that Argentina is going to have another Milei in the future?
First, he himself has recognized that it was very rare for a libertarian like himself who came, you know, with a chainsaw and saying, this is what I'm going to do to get elected. He himself has said, you know, the situation has to be really bad for someone like me to be elected. So, but on the other hand, let's not get ahead of ourselves. He's 1 year into a 4 year period government. Argentina is starting to get out, you know, inflation is improved, macroeconomic situation is improved, but there's still a long way to go. And many things could go wrong. He himself has admitted that there are still a lot of things that have to be done. We still have to wait and see what's going to happen. And then we will be able to talk about his legacy.
Veronica Smink of BBC Mundo. You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Farina Kamidi, and this is The Fifth Floor. I personally love going through old pictures. There's something magical about old black and white images. If you're like me, then go to the BBC Africa social media channels. There's a wonderful video there. It's about the restoration of thousands of beautiful portraits taken in a small town in Uganda in the second half of the 20th century. Christine Otieno is the journalist behind this project, and she told us how the story came to light thanks to a series of chance encounters.
So I got a call from a friend of mine. He's a documentary maker from Uganda. He's also a Hollywood actor, and his name is Ntare Gumombahomwine. And he called and he said, hey, I've got this documentary that I have done, and it's about a photographer that I met 22 years ago in a small town in Uganda, in Birizi, which Ntare actually stumbled upon because his car broke down there. And whilst he was waiting for his car to be fixed, he was walking around with his camera, snapping away pictures, and he saw the photo studio. And then he wandered in there. And the photographer, his name was Chibate Salungo. Chibate then pours all of these negatives at his feet, and he was like, whoa, what is this treasure trove?
Oh my God, when I first discovered Chibate's work, my breath was taken away, because I'd never seen a rural photographer documenting thousands and thousands of people's lives.
Chibate, he had all of these old negatives. A lot of them were in really, really bad state. And Tara was kind of like, okay, I'm going to try and get some of these negatives restored. It took him 22 years because he hadn't quite considered how expensive it was going to be. And as a struggling actor in Hollywood, it wasn't really that easy. So it took him a while. He got a starring role in a TV show, and he used his first paycheck to go and make a few of these negatives. Over the years, he went to see Mzee Chibate often, and he promised him that he was going to get a book out of this. But as the years went along, he thought, you know what? I could make a documentary out of this, and a documentary he made.
So there's one image in particular that I found really haunting of a wedding couple. And the bride is dressed in this incredible gown. You can see her clearer than the husband. And the groom, you only see one eye. And it's like he's still saying, I'm here.
Chibate he explored photography. When I look at his pictures, it wasn't just the normal sit in a studio and then, you know, one, two, three, flash. It was also sit on a stool outside a bar. It was posed by a bicycle against a mud wall. He was trying to capture the personalities of the people that he was photographing. So when he did this stuff outside the bar, there were patrons of the bar. And there was one particular lady who, she was very stylish, very beautiful. And there's quite a lot of pictures of her. And I remember Ntare saying to me, he wondered why this lady was on these pictures with so many different men. And he wondered what her story was. Turned out she owned the local bar, which was posing with her customers. And then there was pictures of this guy who used to repair bicycles. So there's a picture of him and his bicycle. He captured life, just rural life in a small town in Uganda.
There's a large series of images of same-sex friendships or same-sex couples. We might never know what the story was behind those because many of those people had passed. But one of the key things in these photographs was love.
Some of the pictures that really caught my eye and Kotantare's eyes were, there were pictures of same-sex couples. They were either holding hands or looking at each other. And what struck him about them was they were telling a story of friendship and intimacy. And in the documentary, he didn't know what to do with these pictures because Uganda passed a law that criminalizes homosexuality.
In the old days, you could hold hands with your friend and there was no issue. But now, with this passing of this bill, people are afraid to just hold hands.
So the pictures that Shibata took were from the late 1950s and carried on to 2016, just before Shibata died. And Tari was quite sad that he didn't get to see the work that he did. But his family has seen the work, and more importantly, the people around there. So Ntare went back in 2021 and had this huge outdoor exhibition. So he had these huge canvases. He got the pictures, printed them all out, and hung them out. There's a guy on a motorcycle with a megaphone, went around the town saying, this exhibition is showing if Mzee Shibata ever took your picture, come along, have a look, you might find your family members. So people showed up. One thing that I quite loved was this guy, he comes bouncing in and he goes, "That's my dad.
I've seen the photograph of my father."
"Your father?"
"My father."
"Wow. This one?"
"Yeah."
"Had you seen this photo before?"
"No."
He had never seen a picture of his father because his father died when he was a baby. And that was the first time he laid eyes on his dad. And he was like, "Whoa, I am so happy to see this." And another one that tickled me was this group of people. They were crouched in front of a picture, and it was a picture of kids. And the one guy goes, "Hey, that's my father." And another guy goes,
"This one is a teacher. This one is a midwife.
This one is now a midwife. This one is a teacher." They're all grown. They're professionals. And what Ntare did was at the end of that exhibition, he handed out scissors. And people could snip the pictures and take away the copies of their loved ones. And the other thing that he did that was so cool was people who were in the pictures that Shibata had taken, now all grown, some of them in their 70s, 80s, he took pictures of them now holding their wedding photos that they had taken like 20, 30, 40 years ago. It was just something so special about it. It really made me think about family photos, because these days with our mobile phones, we go around snapping 1,000 pictures. I don't know when we look at them.
BBC Africa's Christine Otieno reporting there. I'm Farinaik Hamidi. The Fifth Floor team this week was
Alicia Joya
and
Hannah Dean.
The sound engineers were
Sue Mayo
and
Steve Greenwood.
You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.